I hereby call the meeting to order.
So just to give a quick run through of what we're going to cover, we should all go around and just say who we are. That's partly for the recording. Then we're going to spend, 5 minutes on formalities, talk about who the board of directors are, and then the most of the goal of this meeting over the next hour and a half is to talk about our progress over the last year, our plans over the next year, our performance review, compensation for me and Ellie. So that's basically what we're doing. So let's start off with some quick intros. I'm Holden, co-founder of Givewell.
This is Alexander Berger. I'm a research analyst.
Bridget Slipka, new board person.
Tom Rutledge, board person.
Phil Steinmeier, pretty new board person.
I'm Ellie, another Givewell co-founder. All right, San Francisco folks, why don't you go now?
It's Carrie, Givewell, Carrie Tuner, Givewell board member.
Hi, this is Tim Salim-Lawton, research analyst.
Hello, I'm Shetler, research analyst.
And then we have Greg. Is that it, right? Okay. Greg, you want to say hi? Greg does not want to say hi. Okay.
We're still on.
We're still on, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, cool. He's probably on mute. So we have the first thing is we've got a prospective new board member, Bridget, and Tom and Tim both talked to her. We're proposing an election of the board for her, and we've also put out a ballot that's kind of a formal re-election for other board members. As far as the offices go, we have these four offices: president, vice president, treasurer, secretary. I'm the secretary. We don't usually put much thought into the other offices. What I'm about to say contradicts the agenda, but we're going to have Tim keep the office of vice president, which we already hold, and Carrie, if it's okay by you, we'd like to make you the treasurer, which the main thing is that you have to approve certain expenses and can't be on payroll, but Carrie's not on payroll. And then we're going to keep the only other position is Tom as president. That's staying as is. So that's kind of the proposal. I think we're supposed to do all this. I think we should probably do the offices by, like, voice vote, and then the elections by ballot, because that's what we're supposed to do. Do we have Tim now?
This is Greg. I somehow dropped off.
Oh, okay. Okay, Greg. So, Greg, we're taking care of formalities first. This won't take long, but we're first. I think I made a proposal for, to give the office of treasurer. Actually, Carrie, we didn't talk about this because this is. I can talk about this more with you later if you want. So, if you're not comfortable with this, let me know. But I think it would be.
I'm comfortable.
Okay, cool. So we're gonna vote on the proposal to make Carrie the treasurer, keep the other offices as they are, and add Bridget to the board. And then I think the rest of the ballot we can do in written form. That sound okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So I'm in favor.
Ellie votes in favor.
Phil votes in favor.
Tom votes in favor.
Carrie votes in favor.
Okay.
And then do we fill out this thing?
Yeah, you're going to fill out the ballot that I attached and just give it to, I guess, Tom, or email to Tom.
Greg into it.
Doesn't
okay.
need to. We have a majority. But can you vote in favor, Greg, anyway?
What do you want to do? Vote
just,
on paper?
Yeah, in favor. No. In favor.
In favor, yeah. Vote
okay.
in favor.
Okay. Awesome. All right, so let's move on to the more substantive part of this meeting. The annual review and plan. So we put out about a month ago, no, more than that. We put out a couple months ago, and a month ago I emphasized that you guys should read it. A series of blog posts that describe where we've been over the last year and where we're going. So I'm going to give a quick summary of what we think the major progress was, what our kind of plans are, and then we're going to open it up to questions. And this is kind of, what I anticipate being the meat of the meeting. I think this is a time to think about, is Givewell on track? Are we emphasizing the right things? Is our plan good? Have we made good progress? So, I would say we spent a lot of 2012 on kind of our traditional research, the same stuff about proven cost-effective, scalable charities. We added one new charity to the list, number 2, GiveDirectly. They give direct cash transfers to low-income people in Kenya. We did very deep investigations of our top charities, which stuff like, you know, investigating whether we should be concerned about the development of resistance on the part of mosquitoes to the technology that's being used to control them, the insecticide and the bed nets, and a whole bunch of issues like that. And I think that research was good for our credibility. I think we did a really thorough, kind of like, you know, unusually thorough job understanding the things that our three top charities do and all the different ways that you might compare them. I also think that that work was not the most efficient way to spend time for the goal of finding the best giving opportunities. I think we learned a ton about a lot of concerns, and we ended up just about where we were. And I think when we look at what we wish we'd done, been able to do differently in 2012, although I don't know if we were able to do it, but I think in 2013 we will be able to do it, is put less emphasis on our kind of traditional work of proving cost-effective, scalable charities. Because I think at this point we've done that at a level of depth that's pretty intense. And I think what we want to do instead is something that we didn't make enough progress on in 2012, which is exploring new causes. And that's something we're going to be talking about at tonight's open research community event. And, you know, there's all these other things that philanthropy does besides deliver things to poor people. There's political advocacy. There's funding scientific research. There's just, like, general higher risk, higher reward projects. This is probably Tim. Can you get this on? And so I think that has to be the focus of what we're doing in 2013. But we did, that was where a lot of our time went in 2012. On the donor side, on the dollar side, we had good growth. Our total money moved was estimated at $9.6 million. That's compared to around $5 million for 2011. That, you know, about something like $3 million of that came from via Good Ventures, but that still leaves over $6 million coming from individual donors, and that's, you know, roughly double what it was the year before. One thing to note, though, is that it looks preliminarily like growth is falling off this year. And so last year, I would say we continued to have strong growth. But this year, I think our growth is more like 25, 30% year over year so far.
In the first 3 months.
In the first 3 months. It's always hard to say what that really means because the first 3 months don't have that much action compared to December. But, you know, that's certainly something to keep an eye on and just keep in mind. I personally think that even if growth slows, I think our priority for the next year or two has to be exploring these new causes, not marketing. But that's certainly something that's open for discussion. And then I think, you know, when we talk about 2013, we're going to do regular updates on our current top charities. We're going to keep that GiveWell traditional going, and we're going to try to train our growing set of employees to run it so that it doesn't need our involvement in everything. But I also think that, you know, one of the biggest things we're going to be, the main thing that we're going to be putting our most effort into is expanding into other causes, like I said. So that's kind of the big picture of where we've been, where I think we're going. And that's just kind of a summary of all the blog posts that we sent out. But that's, I'm going to stop there and get thoughts.
Can I back you up a little bit and drill down on one thing that you mentioned?
Yeah, sure.
You talked about in 2012, you spent a lot of time going much more in depth on some of the sort of existing charities and methods and talked about, like, going as far as drug resistance or net resistance. I'm not quite sure what kind of some sort of resistance with the malaria. Where did that research did some of that research come through in some fashion? Is it on the AMF page? I didn't see it in the blog. If it
was on the blog,
was it?
It was.
We wrote a blog post called "Rethinking the Case for Insecticide Treated Nets."
Okay, maybe
which was a lot of that and like linked to it. I mean, some of it also is just like part of the updated malaria report page.
Right.
But that blog post would be like the main thing that pushed out the other pieces.
There were several blog posts. So there were like, I would say there were two major blog posts on bed nets and two on deworming. One on bed nets was like this whole vetting we did of the case for bed nets and all these like little things we found, none of which changed the big picture conclusion. And then another post was about insecticide resistance specifically. And then on deworming, we did, you know, one post on kind of a new literature review that came out on the case for deworming, and then another post on this reanalysis we did of a major study that we were afraid might be flawed, and we didn't really find major flaws.
I would just sort of add to the agenda of at least things to consider and see what others think, but I'm often the advocate for improvements to the website, navigation, and usability and presentation to make sure that the research that is done is in a way and presented in a way that it's navigable by users of varying time. You know, some people will spend vast amounts of time drilling down, some people will spend little, but, you know, you need to sort of handle the spectrum, and I think the website can sometimes be a little bit unwieldy in terms of navigation.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be... I think it was mentioned in the to-do list, but it was a very low priority. My personal preference would be to see it be, let's say, at least a medium priority, if not a little bit more, to focus on the website a little bit.
Right. So this is, this has definitely been a recurring conversation among the board. I think that we, I certainly personally feel, very strongly at this point that it should remain as low a priority as it is. I think that when I look at what's going to cause GiveWell to succeed or fail, and what I think is really crucial over the next few years, it's getting broader. It's being more useful to big philanthropists. It's being more useful to philanthropists who are looking at more areas than just direct aid. And I think I just want to emphasize how hard this is. I mean, I think it's probably not something that I have to argue that it's really hard. I mean, it's something that it's a much bigger, more ambitious undertaking than our current research. And I think if we do it well, I think we will have, we will be kind of the people who have thought the most systematically and most compellingly about how to do the most good with your dollar. And I think that's a case that we'll make in a lot of ways, but a lot of what happens with GiveWell, with our outreach, is word of mouth, informal conversations, our open research community events, our Q&As, our blog posts, our networking. Like, these are a lot of what account for our actual growth. And I think especially with the move to San Francisco, that is what is going to put us in a position to be kind of the most useful advisors on how to do the most good with your dollar. And to really challenge the way that everyone does philanthropy, because, our principles of being transparent and systematic won't just be applied to this narrow area where evidence, where everything's evidence-based, and it'll instead you'll see a more broad application. So that's what I see as, really challenging, takes everything we have, really core. If we do it well, it really broadens our potential. If we don't do it well, I think we continue just to be this kind of narrow thing that's seeing slowing growth. And I just think that's what we need to do. That's what takes the capacity we have. And one of the things I think about our website is that, if we put a lot of effort into making the website better, that effort has to be designed around the message we have today. And it's going to be a very different message tomorrow. And I think that our message reaches stability within a sector, but I still think our overall approach to giving is so much in flux that whatever we do now, it'll be redone from scratch within a year, I think, or ought to be redone.
I just about completely agree with Holden on this. This is Tom. I think the potential for the Silicon Valley and Bay Area network is really high, and I think sort of recruiting and developing champions out there is a potentially really high impact kind of marketing pursuit.
Sorry, we can't hear anything now.
I think everybody should be on mute if you're not in the room.
Yeah.
Tim, probably that means you.
I took it off mute for something to say something, but then got beat to the punch. I'm back on mute now.
Okay, I'll get closer to the laptop. Maybe that'll help. Can you guys hear me better now?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I was just saying, I'll be brief. I was just saying, I pretty much agree with everything Holden says. I think that the value of developing the Silicon Valley and Bay Area network is really high, and figuring out how to sort of develop some champions who can either be big donors or spread the word and leverage their networks is really valuable. And I think that's, in terms of marketing bandwidth, I think that should be a priority, probably ahead of the website. I think, and then I think the other dimension that's really potentially high value for marketing is sort of integrating into the philanthropy community. I think it's really exciting that you guys have had a chance to work with the Gates Foundation, for example. So those opportunities, I think, are really golden from a marketing standpoint. I guess the one thing I would say about the website that I think would potentially be helpful is if it could be a little bit clearer to sort of new visitors to the site, what the difference is between kind of the main website and the blog, and what they'll find on the main website versus the blog. I mean, I think that's, I mean, I sort of have a general sense about that, but it's not obvious when you go in. And I think if you just go into the website, you may overlook the blog altogether. And there's a lot of really valuable stuff in the blog, both in terms of the research process and in terms of generally the philanthropy community. So that would be the one, and that may just be sort of like a quick fix on the homepage or something. So yeah. I would just throw that out.
Yeah, I mean, in practice, it seems like a lot of the way we communicate right now is that, like, we have these open community events. We get a lot of questions by email. We get a lot of questions at those events. We think about what people are talking about, what they're thinking about, what they have in their mind. And then a lot of the blog is addressing that. So a lot of people primarily follow us by the blog. And that's a pretty good way to follow us. And if you follow us on the blog, you usually know, like, what's on the cutting edge. And then people tell their friends and they explain to their friends. So a lot of this stuff is more informal communication. What is true is that if you come to the website, you know, it's not showing you everything we have. And I think it's a problem. It's something I would fix if I could. I just don't think it's worth... I think it would take a lot of effort to do it right. I don't think it's worth the effort compared to what we'd have to give up for it at this point.
You're up, Tim.
I'd like to, you know, and John can call, but hear more about the plans for experiments in Silicon Valley and what's happening there to maximize those opportunities and what's being tried, and, you know, what's our evidence stream on what's working and what's not working there.
Yeah, so I want to be clear. I mean, I also don't want to, like, make a claim that where we're putting most of our time or effort is networking in Silicon Valley. That's not the case. I think what we're most trying to do right now, what's taking up the most of our effort, is trying to broaden our research and to hire the people who can help us broaden our research. Those are the things that really take the time. And I think we're doing that to position ourselves to be a more helpful part of the conversation in Silicon Valley, because I think this stuff that we have right now is... You know, it appeals to some people, but it's not going to make the most compelling case for us as having the best information about how to do good with your money. You know, we've only been there a few months, so I don't really know what I have to say. I mean, we held a research community event in San Francisco last year, late in the year. We held an office-warming party this year. You know, they were both, like, had pretty good attendance, but we're, you know, and we do take opportunities here and there to network with people. But I don't know that we. This is not something intensive at this point.
Yeah, I mean the big picture of GiveWell right now is our number one priority is doing research to expand the scope of what we do. The number two priority is talent identification and development, recruiting, managing, training to do more of that research, and. You know, we recognize that, like, we're not putting the time into outreach, either website or in person, that we could, but our bet is that research is the best way, both to, like, make GiveWell a better at what it does, but also, like, ultimately grow the size of what we do down the line, because without that research, we don't have the opportunities to take the donors who can use them.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, for those who are curious about the move, I mean, I would say that, you know, being able to co-locate with Good Ventures is something that is really beneficial for the research. And that's something that, like, you know, in the short term, I think that's where we're seeing the biggest dividends to moving. I think that helps a ton to be able to coordinate really well. You know, I think Good Ventures helps us get access that we couldn't get otherwise, and Good Ventures is you know, helping us in other ways as well. To just make the research better. I think, you know, another minor benefit is I feel like I'm in more of a community of people who are in the science world, and for understanding science, like, I'm finding that helpful. It's, like, much, much easier to be involved in that stuff out there. It's basically not possible here, or I wouldn't know how to do it here. So those are... Yep. What? Okay. So those are, like, a couple short-term benefits. I think this... Someone is trying to talk.
Oh
no, that's
echoing.
My echo. Okay. I'm going to keep talking for now, but we may have to do something like dial in on a cell phone.
Why is it echoing?
This just happens sometimes on Skype.
Okay, let's keep going.
Would you mind, like, calling this on my cell?
Yeah.
Okay, and you did it first. Okay, so anyway, so those are two kind of shorter term benefits. As far as the, you know, as far as really kind of doing a heavy networking and outreach, I think that's something we're working on in kind of a low-key way. you know, like I said, I mean, we had the couple events. Word is kind of slowly getting out. It's kind of a thing that happens organically, but it's not something we're making a big push toward right now. But I think at the time when that makes sense, I think it will also be the right place to be for that.
No, well, when the time is right, and it may not be time to turn here yet, but I'd be interested to know a little more in detail about your second priority of building up staffing. And
yeah,
how
we can talk
that.
About that. Ellie, you want to talk about that?
Sure. Just moving the mic closer to me. So, I mean, we made it a major priority this year to build staff. And like what we're trying to find are more people who can contribute to the research that we need done. So we have one person who's on the line, Tim. Tim, the research analyst, not Tim, the board member, who started a few weeks ago. And then we also have another guy, two people starting in the summertime and more people in the pipeline. And basically the goal there is both people who can do the research, contribute to the research we're doing today, but we're hoping to, we're looking for people who have the flexibility to also be able to do the types of research that we haven't done before, these like newer causes that Holden's talking about. And then the third thing that, you know, frankly, I don't think we thought about sufficiently before, but is a big priority for us now, is finding people that, like, we are going to hope to develop into managers themselves. I mean, we're certainly running into an obstacle now where I'm the main person who manages people. There's only so much time in the day to manage, and you know, right now we have 7 people on staff, and so that, you know, I'm kind of bumping up against my own personal capacity to just check in with people and push things along, and so that's something else that is part of the goal of recruitment, finding those people who can add to our, you know, management capacity, not just our research capacity. The types of people we're not looking for are people who are more on the, you know, like all these other things, tech side, fundraising side, marketing side. You know, we're very much prioritizing the researcher over the outreach marketing person. I guess one more thing I should add is, like, definitely recruiting is challenging for us because, you know, I mean, I know it's challenging for everyone, but, like, there's no background you could have or degree you could have that would make you a fit for what we do. You know, it's a strange combination of skills that we need from someone. You know, even though we've been around for 6 years, we're still small. Our mission is evolving, and like the, you know, each individual person we add to a 7-person team can add a lot of benefit, but also have a lot of costs if it doesn't work out well. And so finding a person who fits in has been tough for us. And so the approach that we've taken to recruiting is a very, I'd say, heavy-handed upfront approach to working with people before we bring them on, where they work part-time or volunteer for us, or we pay them for some trial work to find people who both can do the work but demonstrate they can do the work and also like are comfortable working in our office environment.
Do you think there's a problem with sort of those trial periods that you might lose interested candidates who want to start aggressively right away?
Yeah. I mean, we haven't seen, I mean, there's only been one person for whom I think that was like a direct tangible problem. But I mean, we're very explicit with people who enter the recruitment process that we're not going to interview them for 5 hours and make them a full-time job offer that they'll have for 2 years. And so, I mean, even if you, like, when we communicate with candidates, we ask a lot of them up front, and I know that we could easily be losing people. You know, that said, the combination of the fact that, like, interest and passion about what we do is a really core part of what I think makes a really successful employee, and we just, I don't think there's another good way. Like, we could try the, like, we'll give you a 1-year contract, you know, type recruiting approach, and I think that would ultimately be a lot more damaging. And frankly, like, I'm pretty, you know, I'm really happy with the the staff we have, with the people we're bringing on. Like, I think we have a great group of people. And so I think the costs of, like, the two bad employees are probably higher than, mm-hmm. you know, if you, in that type of committed way, are, like, higher than, you know, losing one person who could be kind of good.
When folks have left, have you done, like, an exit interview? Are you aware of what the reasons may be for why there's not retention?
Yeah, and we talk a lot with people. So I don't think we want to get into, like, individual staff examples on now, but, I mean, we communicate a lot with them about how things are going. They're telling us how things are going. We have a really good understanding of, you know, what has happened in every case.
Cycling back a little bit, you were kind of a little quick to dismiss the one-year contract thing, but what if it was phrased a little differently, structured a little differently, as more of, like, you know, one-year fellowship, so that rather than doing summer internships where you've only got 10 or 12 weeks with somebody, which may not quite be enough time, you know, you get somebody for a year after college, and, you know, it's very explicit up front that it's a one-year fellowship, and yeah, obviously you might... Some of them will hopefully latch on for longer, but there's maybe less damage both ways if there is no re-up afterwards.
Yeah, we've thought about, you know, all the different, what's the timeline that we need. I mean, really the summer is basically the perfect amount of time to, like, learn a lot about someone. Like, I think 3 months gives us a ton of information. Obviously more is better, and so we're trying to do more of that when we can. You know, get people. I mean, it's ideal when you find people who are in school, right? Because that's the situation.
Okay, so if that's the case, then, you know, why not be more aggressive with summer internships, especially for, you know, folks who are finishing their junior year and would potentially be available thereafter?
Yeah, I mean, we have a summer intern coming on this summer. You know, one of the big questions we have is, like, to what extent we want to build the capacity right out of college versus people who've worked for a few years already. You know, I think that it's good to have some capacity on the really young end, but we also are finding people who are a few years into the career who are also really helpful. You know, in particular, there's a lot of additional overhead, like management training overhead that comes with being someone's first job out of college, right? Like, just knowing what it's like to have a job is in and of itself a skill and being used to being in the workforce. So I actually think, like, you know, our guess is that hiring people a few years out is going to be, like, a bigger or a better fit of a pool of candidates than right out of school, as our like, where we, I think, more of the people will come from. And of the, like, four people who either, like, have just come on or could come on this year, like, three out of four are already into their careers a little bit.
I know you don't want to talk about specific exit interviews or specific individuals, but are there themes in terms of what, you know, what has tended to make something not work out? I mean, obviously there's a pretty high cost to not retaining people, so I'm wondering if that deserves a little more scrutiny.
Yeah.
We've been reflective about this. I mean, I want to be, you know, careful about individual cases. I could say broadly, like, it's work often changes at GiveWell. Our situation often changes. The things we prioritize change. And so, you know, I feel like one of the things that we are trying to kind of do more than maybe before is really think about people who we can imagine doing lots and lots of different kinds of work, and not base it so much on, okay, here's a trial that is something like, this is what we do every day today, and, you know, if you can do it, you're on, but instead be like, all right, here's, like, a really broad range of things we can imagine someone doing for GiveWell. The bar is high. We want to be able to imagine someone doing lots and lots of different things and to be able to do kind of, you know, a lot of the more open-ended work. I think that's kind of what we're looking for now, and that is in some ways a response to the experience we've had in the past. I think that seems appropriate and about as far as I want to go. Yeah. But, I mean, we've learned a lot. I mean, we've changed a lot of our recruiting process. Like, you know, and I think a lot of the things we've learned, interestingly, are things that, you know, I don't know if we would have learned them earlier just by talking to people who are more involved in the recruiting, which we tried to do, but it certainly seems like they match the consensus of who we talk to now. And so, for example, you know, outbound recruiting, or I don't know exactly what the word is.
Well, the thing that we've heard a lot, like, yeah. One of the things we've been able to do out in Silicon Valley is talk to recruiters who are recruiting for tech companies and say, like, what do you do? What works? What doesn't work? And one of the biggest things that has come across is, like, having a job posting
that brings in resumes, whether it's just in general resumes or college recruiting, is much less successful than, and that I guess is like an inbound resume, than going to people you know and saying, who are, you know, going to the 10 people you know and say, who are the 10 people you think would most be a fit for the job? And when we reflect back, you know, throughout GiveWell's history on where many of the hires are coming from, it's a combination of people who have just seen what we do and say, this is awesome, how can I be a part of it? Or people who we've proactively recruited, and the like generic job posting, whether college recruiting or otherwise, has been like a lot more effort relative to successful hire.
So that's one thing that I think we've you know, shifted into, and I think has been supported by other people we've talked to. And then another thing is the kind of, you know, and this is related, actually. I think there's a common theme in recruiting, which is that I think kind of conventional wisdom or something says to get a lot of resumes and then screen them using criteria and then interview people and, like, test people and then hire people. And this is just a framework that doesn't seem to work very well. It just has, like, really bad predictive power. And so the framework that we more have is, you know, find people who we know are good, or who someone we know knows are good, people who have a lot of passion for what we do, and then instead of putting them through tests and resume screens and interviews and quizzes, it's, you know, trial with them. Try and get a taste of working with them. So even our kind of, you know, the way it works now is like we'll go after someone and maybe it'll be through a job posting, maybe it'll be a connection, and we'll have kind of an initial interview, kind of a sanity check, but then, you know, we quickly go into a little trial assignment, which is supposed to be like the work we do. Then if they do well in that, we're usually trying to set up some arrangement where they're going to try out working with us for some defined period of time where there's no expectation that things continue after that. And then we're, you know, we're able to really more just like test what it's like to work with someone. And that is also something that I think, you know, that's advice we've gotten from elsewhere. And, you know, I see other companies doing the trial hire setup when they can.
Have you thought about trying to sell the people you don't hire?
That was a joke.
So, I mean, there's a couple other things we could do on this call. I mean, I want to make sure we have time for everything. Like, one thing we have to do is the compensation review, which involves me and Ellie walking out of the room. A couple things we could do. You know, we could take more questions. Ellie could get more specific about, like, recruiting, like, who we've hired, who's in the pipeline, if you guys want. I know something we've done in the past is, you know, you guys talking to our employees about how things are going, although that's hard now with how things are set up with the phone and everything. Because, you know, mostly it's us and board members here in person. But those are some possibilities. So, I don't know, more questions or anything that you guys particularly want to hear?
I think at some point it would be useful to talk a little bit more about GiveWell Labs. How we want to fit that in.
Yeah, so GiveWell Labs is going to be the focus of tonight, is when we're going to, you know, try and make tonight's Q&A really be about what we're doing on the research front. We're also happy to give, like, a real brief overview of that now and, you know, take some basic questions. I think it probably is a good thing, especially since not everyone's necessarily going to be at that meeting, or I guess Greg isn't, but I know Greg is interested in this stuff, and so it's probably good for people to hear that and have a more concrete sense of what it is we're spending most of our time on. So, I mean, I can do a quick version of that now. I think we have time for that, if that's okay with everyone. You know, there's kind of like, I would say there's kind of three levels at which we're thinking of GiveWell Labs and going into other causes. One is that we have a long list of causes that, well, first off, one kind of meta comment is that a lot of what we're trying to do with GiveWell Labs right now is find which causes to get involved in. And by a cause, I mean like a focus area. I mean something like, you know, improving the reproducibility of medical research, or mitigating climate change, or, you know, better immigration policy, or something like that, or malaria control as a cause. And I think one of the things that we've learned over our last year is that I really believe this is the right unit of analysis. I think that we've thought about, you know, looking for the best organizations regardless of cause, looking for the best projects regardless of cause or organization. I think cause is the right unit of analysis, and that's something we've written about that I could go into more, but I'll just say it for now. I think that what we need to do is pick problems that a philanthropist can work on that are a good fit for philanthropy, where there's a big problem, where there are things you can do about the problem, and where the amount of money and effort that's going into it right now is low compared to other problems of comparable significance and tractability. So that's the basic framework. So one thing we're doing is we have a long list of potential causes. A lot of them came from like really random places. And we're doing what we call shallow investigations. And this is work that Alexander's leading. He'll basically look into a cause and try to get, in 10 to 20 hours, get the basics. What is the problem? How big is the problem? Is it a real problem? Are there things we can do about it? Who else works on it? How much money is in it? And creates like a little write-up that is not anywhere near as in-depth as our charity reviews, but gives you kind of a lay of the land. So we published a couple of those. We published one on... It's kind of random, the ones we published, so we don't need to get into why, but we published on asteroid risk. We published on climate change, and I think we published on migration. Promoting migration within developing countries as a way to improve labor mobility. And so that's one thing we're working on, and I think this is something that we feel is pretty valuable, is pretty hard, and it's a lot of what we're interested in more capacity to do. We've recently had an offer accepted for a guy that may be doing a lot of this kind of work. And then, in addition to the shallow causes, there's a slightly deeper investigation where we pick one cause and we try to really understand it. Alexander's also leading that. But so far, he spent a couple months having a large number of conversations with people about reproducibility of medical research and kind of really got a sense of, like, who works on it, what's out there, what you could fund, which I think really does take several months and many conversations to get that, to get a real picture of what the giving opportunities look like. And that's one of the things we've learned is that, you kind of have to look deeply at something to even know what your options really are and how to assess them against each other. So that's one thing we're doing. Another thing that I'm focusing on is trying to understand, I think, the two areas of philanthropy that we know the least about. So I think we know a fair amount about direct aid and the different ways to do it and what's promising. I think that we know much less about two things that are very common in philanthropy. One is funding scientific research, and the other is funding policy advocacy. So I'm trying to, without going into a lot of detail, I'm trying to understand, how to think about those two things, which are very fundamentally different from thinking about direct aid. And, a lot of the same concepts of evidence and stuff don't necessarily apply in the same way. So that's something I can go into a little more detail tonight, but, kind of have a plan at this point for kind of assessing issues in political advocacy and which ones are worth getting involved in and which ones aren't. And I think on the scientific research front, I have a little bit further to go, and a lot of the goal is finding the right scientific advisors to work with, because it's very hard to do anything in that cause without the right advisors. And then finally, there's this other level, which is not about investigating particular causes. It's just about finding out what philanthropy does and what it's done in the past. So, last year we did some very simple analysis of the history of philanthropy, what the big success stories have been, and also the current state of philanthropy, what people work on. And we're trying to go deeper on both those things. So, Good Ventures has been talking to a lot of the major foundations and looking for projects to potentially partner with them on, and we've participated in that. And that's, I think, been very educational to us in thinking about what other foundations do, how they think, how they spend their time, and what we can learn from that and what we can do differently. And then there's also this question of the history of philanthropy, what has worked and what hasn't. There's a lot of claims out there, but I think to assess the claims takes a kind of information that is very scarce. And so Ellie's been working on, can we find people to produce better history, better journalism that can help us really assess whether some of these supposed philanthropic success stories are legit.
I raise my hand. Do you want to pass the phone?
Here's the
comic. So I'm very curious about your thought of what you actually can learn from studying the history of philanthropy, given that virtually none of it ever approached it in the sort of give well way. And so I struggle to understand what you're going to learn other than, we can understand why we don't do it that way. Second, that's sort of related to the philanthropy conversation and the question I asked earlier, but for the connection with all to hell, I am concerned, continue to be concerned about the mix between expanding the research and outreach.
Okay. I'll address those one at a time. So first, on history of philanthropy, I don't think we're just trying to learn like that things didn't work and how they didn't work. I think we're trying to learn what did work. And I think this is something where I actually believe there are some really big, impressive success stories for philanthropy, and I didn't really believe this going in to this project, and so, you know, you want to approach this very different ways. I mean, you could say, oh, all the, like, traditional philanthropy with people trying big things has just been a total failure, and we should distribute bed nets. Or you can say, boy, dang, like, you know, some really big stuff got accomplished by foundations. That's not to say they're all great. That's not to say everything they do is great. But you don't want to leave that on the table, and you should become more open to taking some of these big risks. And right now I lean toward the latter view without really having the quality of evidence that I want to be confident in that view. And so what we're talking about is looking into these claims better. And I think we will. I think we can fund the kind of work that would say, you know, there's this claim about how, about who changed their mind about what and when and how, and can we look into, you know, who the other actors were and what the other influences were and who was really responsible for this social change that's been attributed to a foundation. So I think that's something that, you know, is tractable, is doable. We're not going to get, these foundations didn't evaluate themselves particularly well. We're not going to get an AMF-style case that this worked or didn't work or why. But, you know, there's some big claims out there that I think a sort of historical analysis could definitely change our opinion on one way or the other.
So I'm not skeptical that there are big successes. I'm skeptical that those successes were arrived at in a systematic enough way that there's any way of overcoming the hindsight bias of deciding what it was that led to those big successes, as opposed to...
I can jump in, I actually, this is one, an idea I like, is sort of what are the success stories of philanthropy and sort of cataloging them a little bit. And I don't think it's necessarily... interest in the process. I think you're focusing on the process. You know that, well, all these other foundations use a different process, so even though 1 out of 10 hit, you know, it's kind of random why, my view on it would be interesting to see categories.
Yeah.
Causes.
Yeah.
And some of that has changed, because somewhere in this documentation there was some very interesting statistics that, you know, the government didn't used to put very much money into healthcare, so a little bit of money into healthcare 100 years ago went a long way from foundations. That's probably not the case anymore. But even so, if there's a list of 10 or 20 or 50 or 100 success stories of various magnitudes, if we can see that 30 of them cluster into this area and we only see 2 in this area, and if we kind of get a sense that both areas were very popular, but basically very few success stories came from one area and quite a few from another, I think that's useful information.
And I think I did that analysis at a preliminary level, and I think I have opinions on that now, and it's a question of, you know, getting more information about the validity of those opinions. But we had a post about a year ago called Philanthropy Success Stories. We went through an actual list of 100 success stories, looked for the patterns you're describing, and we've talked about them in the meantime. And, you know, a couple things I'd say today is that I believe that some of philanthropy's biggest success stories were just, like, going into an area that was empty at the time and is no longer empty. And I think that some of the scientific research stuff works that way. And so while there's, in some sense, a very impressive track record of scientific research, you also have to be cognizant that the world of scientific research is a lot more crowded today than it used to be. So that's, like, one observation. Another observation is, like, I think philanthropy has done some good by getting into a cause in policy advocacy, building up capacity over the long run for groups to advocate and to lobby, and eventually having their moment in the sun and making a difference, which is a very different model from, like, you know, what's the issue today that's in the news that we could change in the next year. And if I believe that's a valid model and it works, what I want to do is I want to look for issues that matter but that don't already have that level of investment and capacity and organization and lobbying ability and build them up, and I'd feel, like, reasonably good about that basic bet. Not that you want to be building the exact same machine that was built 20 years ago, but this basic concept of, you know, be ready for the moment when there's an opportunity in a cause where people aren't ready today, I think is kind of compelling. On the flip side, you know, I think a lot of what foundations do today is they try to do a pilot project with a developing world or a developed world government and figure that, you know, that project will go well and that it'll be taken over. And this is something that, like, I don't know as much about the track record of, and I'm a little more skeptical of, though. Like, I don't know that, you know, these kind of investments in working directly with the government and trying to build something that then gets taken over. I want to look into them more, but I haven't heard as much compelling stuff about those.
Well, that's basically the village reach model.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, you know, one is, if the former is true, the idea that, you know, sort of building up capacity and then waiting for the moment, what's the thought on how you pick that thing so that you avoid just the investing for the long term and that moment never comes?
Right.
Because it's hard to tell that that moment's going to come. And second, what is your belief that the GiveWell constituency is willing to wait that long?
Tim, I mean, another way of just, like, thinking about why we're so interested in the history of philanthropy is, like, here we go into these new areas that we've never looked at before. Like, let's just have a basic understanding of what people have tried before and how it's gone. And, like, that is, like, challenging because the research doesn't exist. But I also think it's, like, one of the first most obvious things to do as you undertake this work. And, like, there's a potentially a group of people out there, journalists slash historians who do this type of work, or slash political scientists who do this work. So let's, like, see if we can essentially build our team's capacity via that route, by saying, can we find someone who resonates with us and how they try to figure out the question of whether a project had impact to go and look at these projects for us? It's slightly outside the normal type of GiveWell work, and so therefore let's find the people in a different way, but that'll have, like, I think will provide helpful information to how we do things, whether it's helping us find the right causes or thinking about particular questions of, you know, that funders talk about today with getting the government to take it over or something else.
So a quick answer on the question of how do you know you're not waiting forever, and then I want to talk about two of the questions you raised that we haven't answered yet that have to do more with, like, marketing, what our audience wants, how big our audience is. So, you know, how do you know that you're not just kind of waiting for Godot with this policy advocacy thing? So I don't want to get too much into this because I'm telling you what my hypotheses are as a way of illustrating what we're working on and what we're doing. I'm not sitting here now saying the GiveWell policy plan is blah and we're going to do it. I'm saying, like, you know, this is what I'm thinking about, this is what I'm working on, and my next step is to investigate it more. But, you know, I also think there is a larger issue here that I think is well illustrated by this case, which is that we're not looking for sure things, we're looking for good bets, and I think our audience is too, and that's where what we're really about at our core is transparency, systematicity, criticality, not evidence. And sorry, evidence, yes, but not proof. And not, you know, the idea is not that this has worked before 17 times, now we're doing it for the 18th time, we know it'll work. That's not core to what we are, and it's not a way we need to be. But what we should say is, here are the cases in the past that make us think this has a high enough chance of working to be a good bet. Let's put all that out there. Let's hold ourselves accountable. Let's have people discuss with us and debate with us, and just have that be a higher quality conversation than if we did this in an uninformed way. But I think this is, you know, this is a way of approaching things that generalizes beyond stuff like bed nets that, you know, you've done it before a million times. So on the marketing, you know, on the how big is our audience question, I mean, I think our audience, I'm pretty confident that our audience is pretty, like, open-minded, is pretty patient, is not, you know, imposing a lot of constraints on what they want beyond doing the most good possible. And I'm basing that on the survey we did. I'm basing that on the conversations we had following up the survey, basing that on conversations we have with major donors all the time. We have a very top-heavy audience, and so we know them pretty well. And so I feel pretty good about that. As far as doing all this research and then running out of audience, you know, I think it's a risk. But I also think that even just, you know, having a major impact on the giving of Good Ventures, for example, would be pretty big. And that's, you know, a group we're working with closely and feel good about. And so that's an illustration that I, you know, when I look at the trade-offs and I look at how many dollars we're talking about for our individuals and how fast that's grown, although the slowing is some cause for concern, and, you know, the fact that we're now where a lot of the people who are just getting rich now and haven't really started thinking about this stuff are, I like our odds, but I don't really know what else to say. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I think one of the lessons we learned from our more traditional work is that it's much easier to sell a recommendation, a giving recommendation, than it is to sell an abstract concept of a process for finding a GiveWell recommendation. And so I don't want to go out there now putting all our energy into networking and marketing this concept of GiveWell Labs when after a year we could have arguments that you ought to get involved in this issue and that issue and that issue because we've looked into it and we know it, and then we'll see how that sells. You know, so it's a risk, but I prefer this risk.
The thing that would make me more comfortable is seeing you guys think about ways to keep track of that, of the out, you know.
Right.
so that there are earlier alarm bells.
Right.
In case... So, you know, it's not that I believe that there's evidence now to that this focus is wrong.
Right.
It's... I would hate to see history repeat and see the pattern tail off too late.
Right.
Well, I mean, we track the donations, right? Like, we know we put quarterly updates on how the growth is coming, so we know what's happening with the individual dollars. Like, we've seen, we'll know certain throughout the year how that's going.
Right. And there is a preliminary warning sign that that may be leveling off a bit, and so we can reassess, you know, when we're more sure of that. My feeling is even if that's leveling off this year, that, you know, we should still focus on research for the next year or two. But, you know, that's certainly something that we can debate and something that we're tracking.
One way to put it, and, like, you know, we have this, like, follow-on meeting in a week, I guess. But part of that will be looking at our budget and our current money move. And I think it's, like, roughly close to the situation where, like, what we want to get to is pretty consistent in terms of budget, is pretty consistent with our current size of money moved. And so that, in a sense, gives you, like, some leeway to grow a little bit and still be within the bounds of what's reasonable. But, you know, this is why we have we do that tracking, so we know what's happening.
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, GiveWell's not going to run out of capital maybe we are, but in globally, I don't think we're going to run out of capital in the short term to have that same sort of no-ramp problem.
Yeah, I mean, just to beat a dead horse, I mean, the final thing is that I really think that doing this research is what I would bet on for marketing more than anything else to, like, really grow the numbers. Like, I think there's, like, a lot of things we could do to the website. Primarily, I think about ways to communicate with, you know, people who are interested but not able to get engaged at the level that they would need to, like, go through the site. But, man, like, doing a great job on these other causes just seems like the best way to get a whole new group of people interested in what we're doing, because people have the very, very obvious objection to our current research, which is that it's so evidence-based, that all these things that could be great we haven't looked at just because they don't have the evidence base, and they go away. And so now we're going to be able to say to them, in a year or 2 years, like, we've done the research, we have found the opportunities, here's how we think about them and how they compare to AMF and GiveDirectly and SCI. And, like, it very much feels to Holden and me like this is exactly a path we've been down before between 2007 and 2010, and we just, you know, essentially need to go through it again.
I would add, though, as a quick counterpoint to your very last statement, that early on, you had some attempts to sort of outreach via networking that were not terribly successful.
Right.
But there was some investment in the website, which was admittedly at a lower state of quality at that point than it is now by a significant measure. And it's hard to assess how much impact that had, but my personal viewpoint is that the website improvement was a high return on time invested.
Yeah, though, the reason I say, like, research is probably the path to marketing is, like, the biggest marketing thing that ever happened to GiveWell was Peter Singer finding our research and thinking it was really great. And he's become our biggest marketer that we've had. And, like, that's the person that, like, I think we need to make sure to serve and not fail.
Right.
Right? Like, we need to have the best answers for the people who are really, like, smart and care deeply about these issues, and they're going to vet what we have and then promote us to others. And, like, the biggest pain point I feel now is not that the website isn't ideal, but, like, I know it's not, but that people have really obvious questions about our research that we don't have really great answers to. Like, the answer that we give about policy and scientific research and any of the other causes that Alexander, you know, we could tell you about is just that we haven't looked into them yet, and we have good reasons for not having looked into them yet, but we don't, like, have some strong belief that, like, AMF is better than any other science research giving opportunity. We just haven't had the time yet.
I'm not going to be dead horse. I'd like to talk with you guys more specifically both about this issue and the history of philanthropy issue, because I think they overlap.
Okay.
How do they overlap?
I think it would be one of those really interesting things to study in the history of philanthropy is how things like this have happened. Geneva Global isn't the only organization that's ever attempted this. There are a number of organizations that have attempted stuff like this and also failed. I'd like to see a little bit more of why they failed and how much that was because they overinvested in research.
Okay, we're happy to take that offline. Do we want to get to the comp review? I think we should probably do that, because that often takes longer than we anticipate. So we can do that, and then if we have time after, we can take more questions. Unless anyone has anything burning about the progress of the last year, plans, or the next year that would relate to that.
The one point I'd make, which I think I've made before, is in context of board members, I think it really makes sense to have more West Coast board members, given the emphasis you guys are making. And I think that's an opportunity to recruit another sort of, you know, passionate spokesman.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we've approached board members...
Kerry wanted to say something.
Oh, could you repeat that?
Yeah. Tom was just saying that, you know, given that we're out on the West Coast, he thinks it makes sense to try and recruit some more West Coast board members.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way that we approach board members is we usually don't invite someone to join our board until we're, like, feel like we have a pretty good relationship with them. That's something that we could debate, whether that's appropriate, but that's certainly what makes us more comfortable, because there's a lot of ways to network with someone besides having them on the board. Having them on the board means bringing them into these meetings, giving them a formal vote, etc. You know, I basically feel like we have done a decent job networking, and a lot of the way that we've networked is by just allowing things to play out in kind of an organic way. It doesn't mean we don't do anything. We meet with people, right? We meet with them constantly, and it's like every time we meet with them, we make like a little bit better impression on them. So, you know, that's led to, well, maybe not, but...
I was going to say...
You know, but the point is they get more confident in what we're doing because we're there, we're moving forward every time, there's news every time. And, you know, I think that's led to good things. So that's kind of the idea, is that we, you know, we know who we want to meet with more often. We're meeting with them, but I think that we don't want to force this stuff by saying, you know, will you be on our board before we're ready with someone?
Yeah, that's fair. Are there any people in your circle now who you think could potentially be board members?
There's no one who's, like, on the list to be a board member in the near future.
So, on the comp review, I mean, we sent out a salary survey that is, you know, I bought the most recent one since we moved out to SF, and since the one we had been using is, like, 4 years old. I'm not going to buy a new one every year. You know, we tried to give some context. I think the basic story here is, like, the right... Like, I think $9.6 million is a decent number to think about kind of the impact of GiveWell and the size of GiveWell. It's a little bit of a funky number because it's about a third Good Ventures and about two-thirds others, but that might be the right way to think about things at this point in our development. That's what the dollars were. And so, you know, with that backdrop, I think that we could be thought of as a larger, more mature organization than in the past. We want... You know, our comp to reflect that, me and Ellie, and we think that me and Ellie's comp does kind of set the tone for the rest of the organization. And so I think this is something where, you know, where that, just to keep in mind. I mean, that's basically what we're thinking. I don't know. If there's any other questions, we're happy to take them. I think the way we're going to run this is that we first would like everyone to have whatever conversation you feel comfortable having with us here. And ask us whatever questions you have about the numbers that we have and about the proposal we're making. And then we are going to go out of the room. I think probably also staff should go out of the room. I think anyone who's paid by GiveWell should go out of the room. And then the board is going to decide. And, you know, I'm just going to put out there that I appreciate the more we can, the higher percentage of this discussion happens with us here, if we can just try to make that happen. Because I think that's, you know... I think we've had times in the past when things just kind of went off on a track where people kind of talked with each other and we weren't there and we were just kind of hanging around. So, but that's fine. I mean, whatever you guys need to do, like, is totally fine. But I just want to put that reminder out there that hopefully we can get a lot of the questions answered while we're here.
Yeah, usually we just, you know, hang out, kick back for a while, stare at you guys out the window, see how uncomfortable you're getting.
Usually there's pizza, so that's a major difference. Yeah.
True. Good point.
So can I just ask generally, do any of the... non-paid board members have any major issues with the proposal?
I don't think so. I would just ask for just a little bit more information. I see a salary here. I'd just be curious what, in addition to the salary, what the benefits look like, and also to what extent this is a change from years past. You know, where it was, where it is.
Sure. So I'm happy to address that. We had 65,000 each.
Hold on.
Oh. We had 65,000 each when we started Yuval in 2007. That went up to 75,000 over like the first 3 or 4 years, and then we're at 90,000 over the last year. And so we've had, you know, slightly steeper pay hikes recently. I think that we want GiveWell to be a hugely impactful organization. We want to get paid, I think, a lot more than this proposal eventually. And that's something we're putting out there that we're happy to discuss. But that, you know, that has to go along with impact. And I think that, you know, we're basically trying to, I mean, look, this isn't the science, but we're trying to raise the pay faster now because we think the impact is growing faster, and we may want to raise it quite a bit in the future too, commensurate with impact. And so that's on the history. What was the other question? Oh, the benefits. So the health insurance is like a few $100 a month per person. And, you know, that's the only benefit aside from, like, there's payroll taxes that are required. There's, like, you know, yeah, state-required workers' comp and stuff. So, but that might add another 10%. That's cost to GiveWell, but that's not really, like, a benefit. The only benefit is the health insurance.
Okay.
Could you provide some context on how the executive salaries are in comparison to the staff salaries?
That's hard. So we don't share staff salaries with other staff. So we could do that, but then I think if that's helpful, like, staff could leave the room.
ultimate question would be, have the staff salaries increased the same way that the executive salaries have increased over time? Has there been that investment across all of GiveWell?
Well, staff salaries have increased, I mean, as a general rule, but I think to get into any more detail, we'd want to just do that.
Yeah, I mean, one big change that has changed since GiveWell started is, I think when GiveWell first started, the starting salary for new staff was $35,000 a year, and now it's $45,000 a year. You know, again, like, very low numbers. You know, we think probably everyone at GiveWell, I mean, we know everyone at GiveWell is making less than they would make somewhere else, and that is a function both of, like, trying to, as GiveWell grows, you know, pay people the way that a more mature organization would, while also, like, not asking people in the way that I think we had to at the very beginning, to, like, make the same type of, like, personal sacrifice to just work for the organization.
Just have staff leave somehow.
Yeah, we can do that. If that's important.
I think that's useful. Let's make sure that there are no other questions that require staff, so we're not sending them out and then bringing them back in, sending them out, sort of thing. So that, can we do that last before we send you guys out?
So we'll come back to this question when we send out staff, and then Holden and I will leave after with staff.
And then only two will remain.
So the thing I have a hard time thinking about here is there are two of you. Right? So, you know, contextually we have no context for this role that is, you know, I think very positive for GiveWell, but it's not sort of standard practice to say, okay, so what's the comparables when there are two executive directors? And I know, I mean, it's not exactly the way it works, but it's, you know, and it's not because I don't feel like it's right. I just don't feel like I have any frame to think about that.
So there is a frame you could use, although I didn't send it out, but I could send out the salary survey has, like, another page for, like, COO, which is, like, you know, obviously anyone who's the COO is going to be, like, not the CEO. So that would be, I mean, I don't think that you want to look at the COO as the same thing,
right?
But the numbers tend to be, like, fairly close.
Okay.
So, I mean, I can send that out. I can email that out now if you want. It'll take me a second to get the page extracted.
Is this salary survey, is this, national, or is this of a particular...
San Francisco. Or no, it's California. San Francisco is a line item on there. And San Francisco is higher than, like, the average, and so, you know, that's a good thing to keep in mind, is if you're reading some of the, you know, some of the disaggregations, you want to keep in mind that those are for California, and you want to be doing the San Francisco version.
At this point, I'm relatively happy in terms of a range that, you know, that COO number is, you know, within, like, 10% of what the CEO just...
Yeah, let me see if I can actually...
Because I'm mostly looking for a frame, not a...
So Holden will give that frame, like, the other frame that I would offer... which is frankly a self-serving frame, but, you know, I think if you think about GiveWell, if you think about the money move number as our influence, like, the number that, like, we're asking for is, like, lower than what the, like, median
for that size would be, like, I think that is appropriate. Like, I don't think it makes sense to just think about that number as our budget. I also think that there's, like, still a great deal of risk associated with GiveWell, and, like, a mature $10 million organization is very different than an organization that hit the number in a single year. But I also think that, like, it's, I don't know, I don't think we're yet, like, bumping up against the point where, like, the size of GiveWell is significantly, like, overpaying the executive role.
So, I mean, a couple quick figures. You know, the median for just the top line median for everything, you know, is 125 for CEO and 110 for COO. And probably those ratios will be kind of, you know, similar.
And have you calculated a staff, total staff spend per dollar moved?
Yeah, that's something that we're going to get into at the next meeting. So I can give a little preview of that policy. This is something we've been thinking about. And, you know, what we've said in the past is that we want to get our money moved up towards 9 times our total operating expenses, because that's just like a 10% overhead figure, which is kind of most people would say that sounds good. We are now at, like, you know, lots more than 9 times our operating expenses in terms of money moved. But I think we do want to get a little bit more systematic about this. And a major question is what role Good Ventures plays here and how much of that money comes from Good Ventures, both on the money move side and on the operating expense side. So kind of a preliminary framework that I think we're going to present at the next meeting is we're actually going to do a little more work to look into what foundations spend on operating as a percentage of the grants that they're giving out, and try to figure out, you know, have a little bit more grounded number of what's actually appropriate, although I expect it to be around 10%. And then I think what we're going to say is that, you know, the money we're not raising, the money move that's not coming from Good Ventures is the number we would use as a target for money that we raise from non-Good Ventures sources of support. And then, you know, anything beyond that, I think it's kind of like, the basic thought is that in order to spend much more than that ratio, at least over the long run, we would want that to be operating support provided by Good Ventures. That's kind of the idea that we've kicked around so far. I hope that made sense. That was a little bit convoluted. It was going to be a topic for another meeting.
One other question I had and I meant to ask. Could you add, I don't know if it's necessarily a full review is merited, but a quick sketch of funding sources for your operating revenues.
Yeah.
And you know, who those folks might be and at what levels, and if they have offered any feedback on this particular issue.
So that is something that was also going to be in the next meeting, and I don't have the numbers in front of me in terms of the revenue sources. I mean, the basic revenue sources are individuals. There's two institutions that are supporting us at the level of $100,000 a year. And we've had that, both of them, for a couple of years and expect it for another year or two. And then individuals, I think, you know, the highest single contribution is around 75.
And that's for operational?
Operational support only right now we're talking about. And then we have, you know, we have a fair number of individuals in the range between like 5 and 75 that are accounting for most of that money. So that's the quick answer to your question. Okay. And that's something like, you know, when you add up all that money plus the foundations, it's something like 650 projected revenue status quo, and I think we may have to raise more as we step up.
But you're not expecting like GiveWell general supporters to balk at these numbers.
No, I don't expect. This is something that I think we will eventually have to talk to them about, but I'm not expecting them to balk at these numbers. And again, this is something where, you know, we tend to know the people who are providing that kind of support.
Can I just sort of air an irony about this process a little bit to me?
Yeah.
Which is, on the one hand, this is a very GiveWell process, and that we're being very analytical and we're benchmarking against comparable charities, and we're sort of thinking about what, you know, what would be a reasonable overhead number versus other charities, and that's all, you know, that's all rigorous at a certain level. On the other hand, part of the point of GiveWell is to rethink charity and think analytically about how charities create value, and, you know, if you just look at what the overhead number is for this versus the overhead number for a charity that's, you know, conceivably creating very little value, it's kind of nonsense. And the idea that, I mean, this is anybody that saw, I mean, we've talked about this in the past, but there was a lot of publicity to Dan Pallotta's TED Talk recently about how there's this completely
phony and sort of corrupt approach to thinking about expenses and philanthropy versus other areas of human endeavor. I mean, the fact that this is not only moving money to very efficient charities, but also creating potentially a model for philanthropy that could be very viable, I think sort of makes the comp numbers that we're throwing around here seem relatively small. And also, you know, if you think about the fact that both Holden and Ellie could be doing, could be in the private sector and making a lot more money, I think there's you know, the number here is extraordinarily reasonable. On that basis.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly feel that way, and that is a little bit of a source of discomfort in this conversation for me, is that I do think if you're, you know, there is something a little wrong with just saying we just want to spend the same ratio as what an ordinary foundation spends, and we're trying to do more than that. Like, another way to think about this that to me is, like, feels more right, although less systematic and maybe more self-serving, is to say, like, we believe in this project, like, we believe it is good for the world that Ellie and I are doing this instead of doing something else. We believe that this pay is way less than we would get doing something else, but it's what we need to feel that we're on a path to what we're going to want to make to stay in this job over the long run, and therefore it's reasonable. I don't think that, you know, I think at the point where we got so aggressive that we were asking for ridiculous amounts, you could say, wow, these guys don't have the right intentions, and this actually does rival what they can make somewhere else and all that stuff, but I don't think we're doing that. I think this is clearly way less than what we'd make somewhere else. I think it's the path of comp we're talking about is something that's, like, kind of just generally reasonable and not, like, incredibly greedy. And so I think if you think it's good for the world and we're able to raise the money that we should be doing this work, and I think it is, then that's the way to think about it. But I also like having the more, you know, the more factual comparisons, because I want people to be aware of what they're comparing to. But, I wouldn't rule out that we could see a day where we're asking for something more like the 90th percentile, what some survey says. And, I would still ask for it. But I do want people to have the facts.
Should we send everybody out?
Yeah. Would the staff thing still be helpful?
Yes.
Okay. So, hey, folks in San Francisco, I guess Eliza and Tim, Alexander's leaving here. Can you guys leave there and then just let us know?
The others, there's two recordings going. You should just be clear about that.
Yeah, why don't we, can we pause Global Meet by hitting star 2-2?
Yep.
So we approve the proposal. I think we want to figure out a way offline to have a more in-depth discussion about what's the appropriate way to benchmark comp.
Okay.
How should we? What next step should we take? Because we've had a fair number of board meetings where we agree to do something and then we don't, because we don't really agree on, like, a series of steps. So let's.
Well, what if to start? Like, we're already talking to you about a couple of things. What if we talk to Tim and have that as an agenda item to decide how to move forward on benchmarking comp?
I'm fine with that. I think Tim has the most developed thoughts about it right now, anyway. So.
Cool.
You can nominate Tim for chair of the executive comp committee. Subcommittee?
Hey, Tim, you want me to take you up to
the subcommittee?
I don't want to speak for everybody here, but can I also suggest that Tim and Carrie in particular talk a fair amount, because I think Carrie's going to have a lot of direct perspective on what you guys are doing.
We could talk with Carrie and Tim at the same time, unless you think it's important. Okay, let's do a talk, me, Ellie, Carrie, and Tim.
Yeah.
Another meta comment I want to make about this meeting. Oh.
I just feel like as long as we're asking everybody else, we should actually ask Carrie whether she wants to do that too.
But it's so hard to hear her. All right.
Okay.
Okay, cool. Other stuff?
So we should, are there other major items? Because people are going to start filtering in about 15 minutes, and we need to set up a little bit. Other things?
I'm fine wrapping.
Guys, hopefully this is a short one. I don't want to be too pedantic about this, but one thing stuck out at me in the notes, which was that you guys are on GiveWell 1.0, you're only going to continue to evaluate charities if you think they can dethrone AMF.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Well, no. They need to potentially be as good as AMF. But if they're significantly below AMF in a couple of different ways, like they don't seem like they're... Evidence is as good, cost effectiveness is as good, or transparency is going to be as good, then we are not going to spend a lot of time on them. But this is actually, like, one of the things I think is really worth discussing at this meeting in 15 minutes.
Okay. I would think it seems to be like something that has the potential to be a top charity should remain sort of in the orbit here.
Yeah. Yep.
Not necessarily number one.
Yeah, so that, but we should talk about this.
For discussion.
Yeah,
I would actually take a different view on that probably, but it depends exactly what you mean. I want to make a meta comment about the meeting. Like, I know this meeting had a lot of hiccups. Like, I think, you know, I think one thing that we're going to talk about, we've had this issue with Greg being harder and harder to reach and get involved in these meetings. And so, you know, a year ago we said we're only going to have Greg come to one a year. But I think even one a year is probably too many now, especially since it's the same one and we're trying to get everyone together in person. So we're not sure if that means, what exactly that means, but I think we're going to try and not force that to happen. I think everyone else is a lot easier to get into a room. And like, I don't know, we'll try and learn from this and make other meetings a little bit less hassle. This was our first attempt at kind of doing a New York meeting when we live in San Francisco, too. So I think
this meeting did not go as smoothly as it should have.
Yeah.
And this will improve it for next time.
And as a very quick meta comment, I'd like to talk to one of the two of you offline about the technology, because it's frankly sucked for a long time, and it continues to suck. And I'd like to see it so that people, if conference calls work, they can work in a way that people who are not at the primary location can reasonably clearly hear.
We worked on this
we'll talk to Phil.
That's an offline conversation.
Yeah. It's surprisingly hard to do, especially for non-primary locations, but we can talk about it.
So Vanilla, just totally parliamentary procedure here. I only have Phil's ballot. Carrie, did you email it to me? I think Carrie, you emailed me your ballot. I need a majority. So
yeah,
three.
Yeah.
So if you guys want to just orally give it to me, that would be fine.
Or email it to him.
Or email it to me. Yes.
Yeah, I think it should be in writing, but you can email it.
Okay.
And I'll email.
In addition to my logistics problem, I had printing problems. I was planning on bringing a printed copy with me. If there's a way to get a printed copy, I'm happy to.
I was gonna say, if I had marked this, we could have copied. Just copied this one, but I already marked mine up.
And I have absent-minded problems, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm gonna email this to you right now. Tom.
I grabbed the wrong folder. So.
All right, I'm emailing that to Tom.
So, do you have printing capability here?
We don't. I think Alexander printed something.
I could print something and pay for it with my credit card. If that's important.
Anyhow, you do. It's fine.
I mean, I just emailed Tom and said I vote for all listed officers. That's what Carrie did, too. That's what I would do.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will send you printed documentation, but yes.
And as a quick follow-up, can you also, once you have the votes that make that official, just send an email back out to everybody? Because when I was voted on the board, I was kind of like, there's going to be a vote. And then like a month and a half later, I never quite heard officially until I asked them, so did I make it? I mean, I thought I made it because I kept being included on all the emails.
How many board members do we have? We have 7?
8.
Okay.
Is there an ideal number of what you
It has to be small.
It's in the range.
You can still have coverage, but
I would say it's
right.
In the range.
I counted up people in the room all the first time.
All right, can we adjourn?
Meeting is adjourned.
Great.